So it's very much a pleasure to be here and to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about some very recent results that were, sorry, is it in focus? Or do you know? Some very recent results of we've gotten on the magnetic, non-magnetic boundaries in cerium, rhodium, indium phi. So the talk will not be quite as advertised. I probably will not discuss actinides, although if a little bit of time exists at the end of this discussion, I would like to advertise some recent results of Nick Hurl on plutonium cobalt gallium phi, which I think are really quite nice. So like I say, this is very preliminary work. In fact, most of the data that I'll discuss today has been obtained in just the last couple of weeks, and in some cases, just the last day or two. But it's revealing, I think, some rather interesting perspective on what happens near a magnetic, non-magnetic boundary in this heavy fermion system. And I think it's pointing in a direction we want to continue to pursue. So I have to acknowledge, before continuing, particularly Tucson Park, Eric Bauer, and Philip Ronig, who are the people that are actually doing the experiments that I'll discuss. And this work is also, in some part of an ICAM collaboration with the University of Illinois, with Wei-Chu Yuan and Myron Solomon. So after introducing to you what the problem is that we're actually trying to study, and the materials that we're using to study that problem, I'll tell you a little bit about the magnetic, non-magnetic boundaries in cerium, rhodium, indium phi that is accessed first by applied pressure, and then secondly, accessed by tin substitutions for indium in this material. And then once I show you those data, I want to discuss what these results might be telling us about the quantum criticality that appears in isostructural compounds, cerium cobalt, indium phi, related to atmospheric pressure. So the problems we're trying to study here are really summarized in this temperature pressure phase diagram of cerium, rhodium, indium phi, which some of you may know already. With increasing pressure, its nail temperature increases slightly, reaches a maximum around 10 kilobars or so. And it's at that pressure where we also begin to see some signature, at least resistively, for superconductivity. If we increase the pressure further, the nail boundary just begins to decrease monotonically until it crosses the TC superconducting phase boundary, below which there seems to be no evidence for antiferromagnetism.
So the dashed line is non-existent.
The dashed line is, well, that's sort of the topic of the talk, basically. whether in fact this dashed line exists or doesn't exist. So that's one of the problems we're trying to address. So we know from neutron diffraction measurements that the ordered moment that appears at atmospheric pressure persists and the magnetic structure remains unchanged up to a pressure of about 17 kilobars. And unfortunately, those measurements haven't been made at higher pressures yet. So this phase diagram then is suggesting a couple of questions. What in fact happens to this magnetism once TC exceeds the superconducting transition temperature? And is this magnetism that seems to suddenly disappear, in fact, continue on in this dashed line and result in a quantum phase transition near 25 kilobars? And if it does, what's the nature of that criticality? And then, as I've already alluded to already, one of the things we want to try to understand is the criticality in this isostructural compound, cerium cobalt indium phi. And so the question is, whether, if this really is a quantum phase transition out here at 25 kilobars, does it tell us anything about the criticality in cerium cobalt indium phi?
Joe, this source squares, is that the ordered moment?
That's the ordered moment, sorry.
Does the ordering
The magnetic structure.
There's only one type of order phase as far as.
As far as we can tell, the magnetic structure does not change.
And this is statement from elastomer under pressure.
Under pressure.
Wouldn't as well suggest we have a first order transition?
That's what it would suggest, that's right. So those are the problems, and these are the materials, which I think most of you are familiar with. Both the cerium rhodium and cerium cobalt 805 crystallize in the same crystal structure. That can basically be viewed as being built from a block of cerium indium 3 separated by a layer of transition metal indium 2, and then these layers are stacked along the C-axis. So both of these materials are heavy fermion systems. The electronic specific heat of cerium rhodium indium 5 is about 400-450 millijoule per mole Kelvin squared above its Snell temperature. And the gamma of cerium cobalt indium 5 approaches 1,000 millijoules once it's millijoule per mole Kelvin squared once it's superconductively suppressed. So as we've already mentioned, cerium rhodium indium 5 is an antiferromagnet. It orders at about 3.8 Kelvin. Its ordered moment is just slightly reduced from what you'd expect for a local moment in a crystal field doublet ground state. And the structure is such that within this tetragonal plane, the moments are aligned anti-parallel, and then this anti-parallel structure spirals along the C direction with a pitch that's incommensurate with the underlying lattice. And cerium cobalt indium 5 has just a slightly smaller unit cell volume than cerium rhodium indium 5, and that smaller unit cell volume corresponds approximately to the cell volume that you would find in cerium rhodium indium 5 at a pressure of about 16 kilobars or so. The cobalt compound is an unconventional superconductor, has a PC of about 2.3 Kelvin, and as we'll come to, it has signatures of quantum criticality already, an atmospheric pressure above TC.
Is there anything known about the inelastic neutron spectrum of the rhodium material?
Very little. And the real problem with these materials is that indium just eats neutrons.
Right.
And so it's really difficult to certainly look at quasi-elastic responses. You can see inelastic responses due to crystal fields and that sort of thing, but very little is known about quasi-elastic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So as we might expect from this sort of layered crystal structure, the electronic structure of these compounds is also quasi-two-dimensional, dominated by sheets of the Fermi surface that are nearly cylindrical. And the band structure that one calculates, this LDA sort of band structure, seems to agree rather well with the Fermi surface topology that's deduced by the Hassan-Van-Alphen measurements. So from these Hassan-Alphen measurements, one determines basically characteristic frequencies that measure the dimension of the various sheets of the Fermi surface. And what these results show is that those DHBA frequencies in lanthanum rhodium indium 5 and cerium rhodium indium 5 are very nearly the same. And because lanthanum doesn't have an F electron, this near coincidence of these frequencies suggests that the 4F electron in cerium rhodium indium 5 is localized and doesn't contribute to the Fermi surface. Now, if we look at cerium cobalt indium 5, these same branches appear at uniformly higher frequencies. That is, the Fermi surface dimensions are larger, which implies that the Fermi surface has expanded to accommodate an additional either electron or part of electron, and that's one of the questions we'll discuss later. At least in the analysis that Nakatsuki, Fisk, and Fisk have done, the thermodynamic properties of cerium cobalt indium 5 suggests that, in fact, that above its superconducting transition temperature, this Ethylacron of cerium has not been completely incorporated into the Fermi surface, but something like 10% of the Ethylacron somehow remains localized. So the question is, what happens really at t equals zero, whether that remaining 10% of the uncompensated Ethylacron really gets absorbed into the Fermi volume, surface volume, or whether somehow it remains hidden and still localized. Unfortunately, these HPA measurements are really not able to completely resolve that question because they don't observe all the predicted branches of the Fermi surface. So you can't tell really what's happening.
In the rhodium case, when you do this Hausdorff algorithm, is the system still in an anti-ferromagnetic state?
Or? No, because it's still in the anti-ferromagnetic state. Right, and so as far as I can understand from what Onuki has done, he's taken that into account. And so that these frequencies are valid comparisons. I couldn't swear to that, but that's what I think. I think that's what he's done.
Okay. How do the masses change in between the three?
So the masses here are very small. The masses here are of order 40, 30, 40, depends on which branch, 10 to 40 actually, and here they're larger.
But let's see, 10% are localized, meaning 10% of gamma is missing, is that the notion?
I'm not really sure what this two-fluid picture really is telling us, to be truthful.
But if we look at the total contribution to gamma from the observed Fermi surface sheets, what fraction of the linear specific heat do you recover?
That hasn't been done quantitatively. What you see in Onuki's work is a hand-waving argument that says, yes, the effective masses are large, yes, the gamma is large, and therefore these sort of hang together. That's the extent of the comparison.
So I would have thought that remind me, you said gamma's around 1,000, right?
For cobalt. Right. Once you suppress superconductivity, yeah.
Right, so the electrons that give rise to some of that 1,000 presumably would have very high masses.
Right, so those unfortunately the ones that are very difficult, if not impossible, to see.
Right, so I would have thought that if you do the summation over the gammas of the ones you see, you probably come out significantly short of.
You come out short, there's no doubt you come out short, yeah.
But not 10%, I would imagine much more.
I think it's not possible to be that quantitative.
I see.
Okay. I think this is probably an issue which would be very good to have some discussion during the discussion session of the week, in the sense that if you really have 10% of the electrons which are outside of Fermi volume, then what happens to Luttinger theorem?
I agree.
Cannot fractionalize the volume.
I agree. I think that's one of the very interesting questions that analysis presents, and I think it's a question that will be raised as we go along as well. So, let's turn to the first question, namely, does this extrapolation in the Yale boundary to p equals zero near 25 kilobar make any sense or not? And at least from NMR measurements, the answer is no, it doesn't make sense. So what we show here are two sets of T1 measurements. One's at 16 kilobars. So I apologize in case you have trouble converting kilobars to gigapascals. Gigapascals, roughly 10 kilobars.
Okay. Exactly.
So, exactly, right. So at 16 kilobars, so you're sort of here where the Nail order takes place first and then superconductivity. So what they see in NMR in T1 measurements is a signature of T1 at this temperature, and then at a slightly lower temperature, they see a kink in slope of T1 data where they also see diamagnetic response and AC susceptibility. So everything looks okay, in some sense okay. So you see Nail order and then superconductivity. Now, if the measurements are made at 21 kilobar here, where superconductivity sets in first, that's this set of open symbols, there's only a signature for the superconducting transition temperature. And T1 just decreases as TQ below TC, as we expect for this unconventional superconductivity. However, if we make this extrapolation at around 21 kilobars, you'd say, well, the altimeter should be around 1 Kelvin or so. If we take P1 measurements down to 200 millikelvin, find no evidence for that magnetism. So that's one observation. The other observation is that these NQR measurements seem to be a little bit inconsistent with the neutron scattering and neutron diffraction experiments. And that is that the NQR frequencies split when the spins order magnetically. It produces an internal magnetic field that causes these NQR lines to split, and basically that splitting of these NQR frequencies is in some sense presumably a measure of the internal magnetic field. What these NQR measurements find is that the internal magnetic field appears to decrease essentially linearly with pressure and go to zero within their error bars at a pressure of around 15, 16, 17 kilobars or so. Whereas we know from neutron diffraction measurements that the ordered moment and the magnetic structure remains unchanged up to that pressure. So something is happening here that we don't understand. So one possibility is that the hyperfine coupling in cerium rhodium indium 5 is pressure dependent, or perhaps something else is happening that we really don't understand. So the picture that's emerged from the T1 data seem to be supported also by specific heat measurements. And what I'm showing here are AC specific heat measurements that have been made by the Grenoble group. And the point I want to, I guess maybe just look at some of these specific heat data. So if we're at a pressure of 16 kilobar here, there's just a single sort of smeared peak which we can identify within the L temperature. But if the measurements then are made at a little bit higher pressure, 18.5 kilobar, you see first an anomaly due to magnetism, and then a very weak anomaly due to superconductivity. And then if we just increase the pressure incrementally more to 19 kilobar, there's only the signature for superconductivity, and further increasing pressure, the feature becomes sharper and more pronounced. So these data then can be put together into a phase diagram that's shown down here. So basically, at pressures below 19 kilobars or so, there's a range of temperatures and pressure where antiferromagnetism and superconductivity appears to be coexisting, and that phase is separated by a line of basically a first order boundary from a region that seems to be homogeneously superconducting. And similar phase diagrams have actually been suggested for other pressure-induced heavy fermion superconductors, in particular cerium indium 3, but also cerium plutonium 2, silicon 2.
Does the NQR give any indication of whether it's a homogeneous coexistence of antiferromagnetism and superconductivity or an inhomogeneous?
The NMR data have been interpreted as homogeneous coexistence of magnetism and superconductivity.
So no satellites and...
That's the claim. I think given the weirdness that's seen also in NQR, I think one, in retrospect, maybe one needs to reconsider how those T1 measurements are interpreted.
And in NQR, the signal was going to zero at?
At about somewhere in here. The internal field is going to zero somewhere about in here.
And the NMR, where is that signal going to zero? Where's the field splitting going to zero?
The P1 data?
Well,
the NQR.
Did you say NQR?
NQR. NQR, sorry.
So why do you think it's going to zero before you hit the two the 1.9 gigapascal point?
We just don't know.
I see.
I certainly don't know.
Joe, this Fouquet dash line, is that from specific heat measurement?
Right, so that's basically the phase diagram that they conclude from these data. So what they see, let's say at 18 kilobar, 18 and a half kilobar or so, they see magnetic transition, very weak superconducting transition. So what basically Fouquet argues is that this is just some small volume fraction of the superconducting at that pressure, and that there's essentially phase separation. So, continue to hit on Fouquet, he's written this sort of nice review article about heavy fermion systems, and I just lifted paraphrase basically a quote from that review, and he says that to his knowledge, and I think this is my knowledge as well, there are no heavy fermion compounds where an anti-fermion phase appears after entrance into a superconducting phase. So the obvious question, that's raised by these data is, what happens if you suppress the superconductivity by a magnetic field? In fact, those are the measurements I'll spend most time discussing. But before we come to those, let me just remind you what we know about the field temperature phase diagram of the cerium-5 at atmospheric pressure. And those two phase diagrams are shown here. They look a little bit different depending on where the field is applied, parallel to the cerium-indium planes or perpendicular to the cerium-indium planes. So, in zero field, we know that there's a paramagnetic to incommensurate anti-paramagnetic transition at 3.8 Kelvin. Then if you go to low temperatures and increase field, there's a change in the magnetic structure from incommensurate to commensurate. And likewise, if you stay at high field and decrease temperature, there's a transition from this commensurate structure, which is called labeled phase 3, to another commensurate structure labeled 2. But those commensurate structures really have not been sorted out completely yet. And that's when the field is in the tetragonal basal plane. If the field is applied along the C direction, it seems as if there's only this incommensurate phase for all field values, up to 9 or 10 tesla anyway. So the measurements that are being made at Los Alamos are AC-specific heat measurements at constant field sweeping temperature. And because we're fixing field and sweeping temperature, these measurements really are insensitive to this nearly horizontal phase boundary that separates these magnetic structures 1 and 3. But what we can see quite clearly are these two things. And so we're reasonably confident that the field is more or less parallel, more or less in the tetragonal basal plane, and we know what we're measuring. So the AC-specific heat measurements are shown down here at the bottom, and so if we pick some field, let's say the blue symbol, 5 tesla, we see one magnetic transition followed at lower temperatures by another magnetic transition. We know that those are not superconducting because we're also measuring the resistance simultaneously. So from these sorts of measurements, we can construct a field temperature phase diagram for cerium-5 at 9 kilobars, so somewhere about in here roughly. Okay? And the magnetic phase diagram looks very similar to what we know happens at zero pressure. As I mentioned, we're also measuring resistance simultaneously, and we see a resistive onset of superconductivity, but not a complete resistive transition. So it appears to be no bulk superconductivity at this pressure.
There used to be, I remember from earlier data, there was this discrepancy between the superconducting transition temperatures measured by specific heat and resistivity.
That, yes, and that certainly is very prominent in, for example, cerium iridium in your 5. It's also pronounced here at low pressure, and I'll show you those data here. So if we increase the pressure from 9 to the 17 kilobar, we see exactly what you mentioned. So let's look at zero field here. What we find is that this onset of a superconducting transition by resistivity coincides almost exactly in temperature with the onset of near order that's seen in specific heat measurements. But the temperature range between the onset of resistive transition and the temperature where the resistive transition becomes zero is rather broad, and in fact we don't see an anomaly in specific heat until much larger, a lower temperature. So there's a rather wide range in temperature between the resistive transition and the appearance of a bulk superconducting transition that's detected by specific heat. If we increase the pressure, then what we see is the evolution of these two magnetic phase boundaries, again very much like we saw at 9 kilobars and at zero pressure. One thing I think that these data are also telling us, the resistive data, is that we don't see any evidence for this bulk transition below at fields above 2 tesla, and maybe just because we have not so high quality data in this case. So what we see is that even at 1 tesla, which are these red symbols, the resistive transition begins to develop some structure. And as the field is increased, that structure becomes more prominent, and in fact at 8 tesla, the resistive transition is incomplete, at least above 300 millikelvin or so. And so this suggests, the structure in the resistive transition suggests to me anyway that there really is spatial phase separation into superconducting domains and antiferromagnetic domains. And unfortunately, from the specific heat measurements, we really can't tell what the relative volume fractions are of those two phases.
Sure, is that
some
vortex flow regimes?
Well, that's a good question. That's also why I had a question mark, because I think these are ongoing experiments. I think we really need to go back and look at these more carefully as a function of the measuring current that we're using to determine the superconducting transition temperature.
This is all for field. I'm confused.
Sorry.
It field along the A-axis or along the C-axis?
A-axis. This is all these data are field in the
plane. Why choose field along the A-axis when the phase diagram is so complicated in that direction?
Just so among other things, so that we were sure that we were more or less in that direction, because it has this characteristic phase boundary, these two phase lines, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That was the primary reason.
Wouldn't it have been simpler to put it along the C-axis where there's only one magnetic phase?
It could have been simpler. It was also a matter of expediency, just because the sample likes to sit this way in the pressure zone.
Okay.
Okay. So let's crank the pressure up another step, basically, roughly another kilobar or so. And here, in this case, what we see is zero field, a very nice, sharp, specific heat anomaly that coincides nicely with the resistive transition. So we have superconductivity first. There's no evidence of magnetism above that superconducting transition temperature. And to come back to Rabaz's point, that the resistive transition becomes very sharp, and the bulk transition detected in the specific heat, depending on how you define that transition temperature, is essentially coincident with the resistive transition. So at least at this pressure, it looks like the superconductivity is homogeneous in this sense. However, as we increased pressure, increased yield, a couple of things happen. So let's look, it's really hard to see these, and I apologize. But let's look at these data, say, at 2 tesla, so the green symbols. So the green triangles, there's a jump. You know, this is the supernecking transition temperature that we also see repeatedly. They come down. There's another little peak right here that has very little field dependence, which we identify with magnetism. Okay. So here we have first superconductivity, then magnetism. And sort of coincident with the appearance of this magnetic transition, these resistive transitions also begin to take on some structure. And again, at the highest yields, it looks like this resistive transition may not even be completed. So the phase diagram that we construct from these sets of data is shown here. So we have superconductivity. We see one antiferromagnetic, one magnetic transition appearing. But the point that I want to really make here is that, let's say, 2 tesla or 3 tesla, we see superconductivity first and then magnetism. So this magnetism that was hidden from us in zero field seems to be revealed when we apply a magnetic field to ceremonial magnetron.
So when the field becomes smaller and smaller,
it's smaller and smaller. If we find out, we can't see any evidence for magnetism, at least above
this. It just goes away.
This goes away. This goes away. So the one question is, of course, whether this is homogeneous coexistence again or not. And if we interpret the structure in these resistive transitions as being phase separation at the lower pressure, then that also may be the case here. The other thing to notice is that there's a lot of scatter in these data, but there doesn't seem to be any significant change in the evolution of the resistive transitions when the magnetic boundary crosses that TC of H boundary. So that suggests, again to me anyway, that these two phases may be segregated, that they really aren't talking to each other. Also, at this pressure, as of Sunday evening anyway, at a field this higher than the superconducting boundary, so at 11 and 12 tesla, the resistivity is T squared from about 30 millikelvin to over 300 millikelvin, so roughly a decade in temperature. So at least once the resistive transition is pretty suppressed, serum radium in 5 at this pressure seems to be a fairly liquid.
What is TN1 and TN2?
Well, I don't know exactly. Presumably they're the same two transitions that we've seen before. But the reason I have these question marks is that in the earlier measurements, like we saw in zero field, the higher temperature transition appeared at a lower field than the lower temperature transition. So this one appears already zero field, this one appears field induced. And at this pressure, they seem to be reversed. So the higher temperature transition appears, but we identify it only at a higher field, whereas the lower transition is identified in the lower field. So I don't know if these are the same magnetic structures or not, but there still are two magnetic phase boundaries that depend very weakly on field.
And where does TN now lie on the dotted line of the original phase diagram? Give me a shot.
Thank you. So we could construct these various phase diagrams of different fields, but I just took 2 tesla as an example, basically. So these red symbols are the ones that we've been discussing already in zero field, and these other symbols then are for a field of 2 tesla. And what we see is that this lower magnetic transition seems to be headed this direction, this higher temperature transition seems to be headed in this direction, and superconductivity just goes in its merry way, it's just suppressed by field as some of the effect. So, I think it's really premature to say with certainty that this, an extrapolation of this dashed line, the zero temperature is what's really going to happen. But these data that we have so far would suggest that in fact that is what happens. So that the magnetism that was hidden in zero field now manifests itself, it still appears to be heading towards a quantum phase transition around 25 kilobars or so. And so this observation then at least provides us with a plausible mechanism for some sort of quantum phase transition in this vicinity.
But it all looks like that quantum phase transition was first order in nature, not second order.
Ah.
And it's not a quantum critical point in that sense.
Sorry, so...
Well, because of coexistence of phases, I have magnetization in neutrons, which...
At the field where you revealed that quantum phase transition, there would be no superconductivity, so there would be no phase coexistence.
Right.
But anything I see so far is a first quantum phase transition.
Right, so that's the point I want to make. So,
okay.
That's the point I want to make. So, a couple of years ago, Onuki's group had actually measured the HPA up to 21 kilobars. So they sort of stopped at about this point, and they saw these effective masses diverging like there's going to be a quantum phase transition. But at that time, the general thinking was that this was a first order boundary here, because the magnetism didn't extend up here, and so they had no idea what that quantum phase transition might be.
Right.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I'm confused with this spot. Let me just add this is coming out of the screen, the field of magnetic field.
Yes.
Right. So then, do I think about this as a critical point at t equals zero, which is somewhere in the pH plane, or I'm planning that there's a line there?
We don't know yet.
Because at zero field, you don't see any signature for magnetism. Is that?
In zero field, there's no signature for magnetism.
So there is something that appears at finite field and continues to be there as you increase this finite field.
That's right.
So I'm trying to.
So if you want to call that line, you've got to stop it.
Nick?
You want to call that line, you've got to stop it.
That's exactly right.
You're in trouble if the line has to be interrupted somewhere in the t equals zero.
But the optimistic scenario is that somewhere when field is big enough to cure superconductivity, there's a line of second order phase transition, which then through the competition with the superconducting order parameter turns into either first order.
But this is something, the line that is. Yeah. This is the line that is supposed to be under my superconducting
cap
here, right? Do you think it should persist in there?
You just take if you had a second order magnetic phase transition and coupled it to a superconducting order parameter, the coupling strength exceeds a certain value, the transition will be first order. However, if the order is just gone, you could well have a second order phase transition by the time you've killed the superconductivity. Well, but it really just depends on numbers. But it's perfectly legitimate to have that.
I mean, one can actually look at the data that was shown just a minute ago, where you could actually follow this blue line, which was above and below the superconduction transition, and one could check what the specific heat looks like.
And right. Yeah, it looked second order above.
It looks second order, but these are, so the big caveat, these are AC specific heat measurements, and so this type of measurement is really not well suited for detecting first order phase transitions. But we can't say about the nature of that transition.
And how reversible are your hysteresis? Is there any hysteresis?
The thing is, there's no hysteresis.
So in fact, the data would be compatible with this second-order finite factorial transition terminating to a line of first-order phase transition, which you just cannot see in this AC specific heat measurement. Because otherwise, this seems like a strange phase boundary.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
Yeah. So, I just want to come back and mention still. So now, anyway, we have this magnetism seems to be merging now, provides a plausible mechanism for a second order phase transition. That combined with very recent results of Onuki, which I don't think they've been published yet, suggests that there really is a quantum phase transition in critical pressure of about 24, 25 kilobars or so. We see the masses diverging below and then decreasing on the other side of that boundary. So the question is, what's the nature of that? Well, one question is, what's the nature of that quantum phase transition? That's also suggested by these Onuki experiments, which find a rather pronounced change in the BHVA frequencies as you cross from below that boundary to above that boundary. And so what these data are showing is that below roughly 23.5 kilobars or so, the frequencies, the main DHVA frequencies, are really not changing. So this suggests that the 4F electron is still localized. Although I think it may be relevant that there do appear some new frequencies just below this boundary, which may imply some reconstruction of the Fermi surface. But once you're on the high pressure side of the same boundary, there's the emergence of these new branches, alpha, I, and A branches, and in particular, the frequencies of these alpha branches correspond very closely to the frequencies of the alpha branches in cerium cobalt in 5, where at least most of the F electron has been absorbed into the Fermi surface volume. And you can't tell from this plot that, in fact, these are the same scales on both figures here.
What are the little sort of filled dots on the...
Yeah, so these are some new frequencies that appear before you reach this critical boundary. And those are not understood.
Or do they have large mass on them?
I don't know.
So what is the magnetic field and
where it's still? It's large. It's somewhere above AC2.
So because I'm not very good with Oersted, so
I'd
say like 10.
Oh, sorry. So these are frequencies in Oersted. This is not the applied field. So this is the way, I don't know what the conversion is, but this is the way, these are the units that the BHVA guys measure frequencies.
But because the oscillations are in 1 over B, so
right.
B is the frequency.
So how many Tesla is 1 over 10?
10 to the 4.
These will be 10 times the
oscillation. Yeah, 10 to the 3 Tesla is the 4 frequencies.
Joe, could we now reinterpret the data and propose that this is a second order phase transition in light of what's been going on?
I think so. In the absence of superconductivity, yes, it looks like a yes.
That would be truly great.
Because the mass increase is a factor of 60 to 5, which is huge.
It is very, very, very exciting. So that's unpublished, these curves.
Unfortunately, that's still unpublished.
Uh-huh. And you're not giving a view graph. You're not giving a PowerPoint talk right now, so we won't get your view.
Actually, these are PowerPoint. I just like to print them out. So okay. I can give them to you.
Okay.
Good job.
I don't know. Actually, we heard about these, I think, in November. in wherever we were, Osaka, or I forgot where we were in November, but anyway, but for some reason these data have not appeared. Okay, so what it, at least qualitatively, what it looks like is that there is an F-localized to F-delocalized transition at this, in a very narrow pressure interval around 24, 25 kilobars or so. And I'm certainly no expert, but this seems to be not necessarily what you'd expect from a conventional SEW type of quantum phase transition, but seems to be maybe more what you might expect from some sort of local quantum phase transition, at least qualitatively. I don't know about the variation effective masses above and below this state.
It has to be, because it's a second order fluctuation.
Right,
exactly. Okay. Fluctuations, whatever
it
up. Make of that.
So,
is it diverging mass that Ranucki's published?
Up to 21 kilobars. I think the higher pressure measurements, so where he actually finds it changing at the critical pressure, I don't think those have been published either. It's all part of the same study report that gives us some
response. So the resistivity shows T-square exactly at the point where the mass is diverging?
Well, that's a problem. It doesn't. We'll come to that in just a little bit. So, I think how are you actually thinking about these? Hopefully you can tell us what the answer is, because I really don't know how to think about these things. So the next point that we wanted to come to then is what happens when we approach the magnetic non-magnetic boundary of cerium rhodium indium-5, not by pressure but by kin doping.
I'm sorry, did you say that resistivity is still T squared at critical pressure?
No, I didn't say that. I say it's a problem because it's neither T squared nor T linear, it's something else.
Okay.
And so, why is something else? I'll come to it in a bit, if that's okay.
Okay.
And has this diverging mass also been seen in a specific heat?
Oh,
no, it hasn't, because you measure arbitrary units.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
There's no way to extract it.
Not that I... No. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately not.
But these arbitrary units are presumably the same for different...
Unfortunately, that's not even the case. So, I mean, there may be ways we could try to normalize it to, say, above at some fixed temperature, but... the measurements, how do I say, even doing that, it's not a guarantee that you have even a relative measure at low temperatures.
But in a way, I mean, to the extent that the extraction of the mass from the Hassmann alpha is reliable, it would set some sort of lower bound for the mass.
Right.
For the specific heat.
Right. Right.
Non-electronic fluctuations, which would add
up
on that.
Right, exactly. And in particular, I think it would also be interesting to actually know what the temperature dependence of that specific heat is,
right,
when you're in that regime. And I won't go there. It's just something that needs to be done. So what happens when we substitute now pin for indium? This next few graphs are all going to be at atmospheric pressure now. So the specific heat measurements, these are real specific heat measurements now, show an evolution of the Yale order to lower temperatures with increase in pin, and those specific heat data combined with other measurements suggest that the Yale temperature is pushed to the T equals zero at a 10 concentration of about, a 10 content of about 0.35 or so. So that's in this, relative to 5 indium. So that corresponds to roughly 7% indiums being replaced by tin, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's even still yet a good comparison, because we know from studying tin substitutions in serum cobalt indium 5 that not all of those tins just randomly take up Indian spots. In fact, they preferentially tend to take up spots in the Syrian Indian plain. So the zeroth order, 7% of the Indians are replaced by 10, but probably it's a greater fraction of Indians that are being replaced in the Syrian Indian plain. So this, at a composition this beyond this extrapolated boundary, C over T is approximately logarithmic in temperature over a rather large span from about 300 millikelvin out to, I don't know, 10 or so Kelvin. Accompanying these changes in specific heat, we also see a rather large change in the resistivity. That's not unexpected. We're introducing a lot of disorder. And in a sample with a composition somewhere out here, you may believe or not that the resistivity takes on T-linear temperature dependence. But these are also ongoing experiments that hopefully we'll have more data by the end of this week. So this comes to Pierce's question about the resistivity of cerium, rhodium, and 5 under pressure. So the point I wanted to make here basically is, at least qualitatively, aside from this disorder that's introduced by 10 substitutions and superconductivity getting in the way of things in cerium, rhodium, and 5 as a function of pressure, at least qualitatively, the evolution of the resistivity and specific heat are similar, whether we're pressure tuning or pin tuning towards the T equals zero transition. So let's just look a little bit more at these resistivity data. What we see is that the resistivity just above TC actually increases a lot, increases by almost an order of magnitude, maybe a factor of 5 or so, and it reaches the maximum at about 25 kilobars or so, which is where this, very close to where this field-induced quantum critical point is. But the resistivity above TC is not linear, whereas it is linear in cerium cobalt indium 5. So it's not linear, and in fact, a T-linear resistivity is not seen until you actually increase the pressure to the 32 kilobars or so. In fact, that T-linear resistivity seems to persist over an unexpectedly large pressure range above the critical pressure. And then the T-squared resistivity is not recovered until some pressure like of order 80 kilobars or so. So you're really far away from this critical pressure of about 24 or 25 kilobars. And so one of the questions is whether you can probably tell me yes or no, is whether this extended regime, what appears to be an extended regime of non-thermal liquid behavior, is characteristic of the localized, delocalized phase transition.
Excuse me, do you have measures on the magnitude?
No. Not yet. It's an obvious thing. We need to see what happens.
Yeah, because then it looks a bit more
sudden
over. Right.
Joe, nobody can tell you. All we can say is it's against the Dresden dogma, which is that there's always a Fermi liquid either side of the quantum critical point.
Right, so we'll come to that as well. So
the critical pressure over specific connectivity goes away. What's that?
It depends on what set of data you believe. So there's one set of data from Japanese guys where superconductivity seems to go away at a pressure of around 60 kilobars, roughly. There's another set from the same group that shows the superconductivity not going to zero, but reaching a minimum and then coming back up again.
But at least in a regime where you do see T-squared,
the superconductivity is either gone or suppressed.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in that sense, finite field will be really
absolutely. So to come back to Dresden Group. if this thin composition just beyond the what we believe is the critical composition, you see, as I mentioned, some sort of logarithmic temperature dependence. And if you go to lower temperatures in zero field, there's a deviation upward away from that log dependence. And in fact, these data are not wonderful, but to an approximation, they diverge like t to the minus 0.3. And if we now apply a magnetic field to these data, unfortunately, again, so far these measurements have only been made up to 300 millikelvin or so. It appears that we don't know what happens down here, but certainly down here, at this higher temperature, this specific heat divided by temperature peels off from this log behavior and approaches a Fermi liquid, a constant temperature dependence. So qualitatively anyway, this extra low temperature divergence and field response is similar to what has been reported by Covarelli on the terbium rhodium 2 silicon tube, where they also see log follows at lower temperatures by this sort of power law and then Fermi liquid like behavior in field.
Is there a substantial nuclear component that you have to subtract here, or is
yeah. Yes. So that's one of the reasons why these data are not so wonderful. They're probably that extrapolation of that line to those data is outside the air. That upturn is not due to subtraction, I would say.
Yeah.
So as we're aware, the Dresden group then has also measured Hall coefficient on this terbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, where they find apparently a change from small Fermi surface to large Fermi surface as a function of field. So the question is whether these similarities between what we see in zero field are reflecting similar physics in thin dope Fermi rhodium indium 5 and terbium rhodium 2 silicon 2. There's some indication that maybe that similarity is not unreasonable. So as you know, for the germanium substituted terbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, the field-dependent specific heat can be scaled in this way, where phi is just c over t times h to the 1/3, and it scales those data onto a common curve when that function is plotted versus t over b minus bc, where bc is the critical field that's required to induce the quantum phase transition. In tin-doped rhodium indium 5, it looks like we're already at the quantum transition, or maybe at the quantum transition, already in zero field. So in our case, BC would be equal to zero, and we just assume the same sort of behavior, basically, multiplied C over T times H to the 1/3, and fool around with this power law of temperature to see what would collapse the data best. And what Eric Bauer found was that t to the 2/3 instead of t seemed to collapse the data best. So qualitatively, the scaling functions are similar, but there is this important difference, namely in this power law dependence of t, which in the terbium rhodium 2 silicon 2, I think was interpreted as reflecting some characteristic energy scale that measures the crossover from non-Fermi liquid to Fermi liquid behavior, and that characteristic energy scale was linear in B, whereas this type of scaling would imply that if you want to use the same sort of interpretation, the characteristic energy scale depends on B to the 2/3, and we just have no idea why that might be the case. Again, these are all sort of results as of this past weekend, so there's clearly more work that needs to be done. So let's just back up for a second and ask, what do we think Tim might be doing in this case? And at least from
so was that two-thirds of age or two-thirds of age?
Two-thirds.
And therefore, T naught should go like B to the power of 3/2.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you're right. Sorry, you're right. Yeah. So we kind of think about what Tim might be doing in these Tyndale ceremony in five by reminding ourselves what happens in Cerium Indium 3, which is this, as I mentioned, the structural building block of these 115 compounds. And what we know in Cerium Indium 3 is that if you replace indium with tin, that the unit cell volume expands. So we also know from Mather's work that decreasing the cell volume of cerium indium 3 drives the nail temperature to zero and induces superconductivity. So if we're expanding the lattice by tin substitution, then in fact we might think naively, if this is just simply a volume effect, that tin should drive the nail temperature higher, not to higher temperatures, not to lower temperatures.
Exactly.
So,
what gallium
something like that? Well, thallium. Mm-hmm. Gallium, the structure is not stable with gallium, so we've tried that a lot. But we need to try thallium more, I think. So tin substitution, at least in the case of cerium indium 3, is clearly not just a simple volume effect, because we're expanding the volume, yet the nail temperature is going down, and presumably it's also not just a simple volume effect in cerium indium 5, because we also see the nail temperature dropping to zero. What we do know about cerium indium 3 is that it's strongly mixed valent. And so this non-integral valence then presumably is arising just because of stronger charge hybridization between the cerium F and the ligand electrons. We also, as Fuller pointed out, we're also increasing the conduction electron count by substituting tin for indium. So it seems to be this combination of both stronger hybridization and increase in conduction electron count that maybe is forcing cerium into a situation where it no longer is happy being, the F electron is no longer happy being localized, but it tends to want to become more itinerant. And at least to Z with approximation, aside from the change in conduction electron count, stronger hybridization is also favored by applied pressure. So let me just stop here in two-thirds of the way through, and actually I should be more than two-thirds of the way through, shouldn't I? Sorry. 7/8 of the way through, and tell you what we've found so far. So it appears that the hidden magnetism manifests itself in the magnetic field, and that provides some plausible rationale for this small to large Fermi surface volume type of quantum phase transition of 24 kilobars. Certainly in cerium indium 5 as a function of pressure, there seems to be this extended region of non-Fermi liquid behavior, at least in the resistivity that extends well beyond the critical pressure. And then there also are similarities between thermodynamic properties of tin doped cerium rhodium indium 5 and the terbium rhodium 2-silicon-2, which also has a small to large semi surface type of quantum phase transition. So the last question then is whether these behaviors that we're seeing in cerium rhodium indium 5 as a function of pressure tin doping are relevant to understanding what happens in cerium cobalt indium 5, and the corollary of that is what's happening in serum cobalt in 5 placing additional constraints on how we interpret what's happening in serum rhodium in 5?
Can you remind us the comparative size of the condensation entropy or the jump in the specific heat for the magnet and superconductor? Are they roughly the same? And the magnet has got a lot of spin entropy because it's 0.8.
Right. So
how much is there in the superconductor?
So I would say there probably are not good quantitative measurements in the superconducting state. Norm Phillips did measure at 21 kilobars early on, but we think that sample was probably not the best sample in the world now. And in that case, it was a rather small jump. It was even less than a comparable BCS jump at 21 kilobars. Mm-hmm. But there's been no quantitative measurements at higher pressures where presumably you're in this homogeneous sort of superconducting phase.
It very much looks as if the superconductor and the antiferromagnet are both competing to eat up the X-spin in different ways. And so you might imagine that if that were true, there would be a comparative amount of entropy in the superconductor.
Right, right. And that seems to be the case more or less in certain cobalt in 5.
Right.
But we don't know that for sure yet in certain rhodium in 5.
And that result also implies that if we're fixing on gate of lambda coupling off, the two order parameters, it's repulsive and it's large.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And therefore, the first order nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'll just briefly mention this since I think several of you were probably here in January and heard John Sorrell, who I believe showed similar view graphs. Just to remind you about serum cobalt in U5, it exhibits this logarithmic divergence of C over T above Tc and a T linear resistivity both over an extended temperature range from about Tc to up to 10 to 15 Kelvin or so. And if you suppress the superconductivity with a magnetic field, it appears that non-free liquid state just sort of tracks down to T equals zero. And in fact, you can scale the field-dependent specific heat shown here in a Maria-type way, where everything is measured relative to a field of 5 tesla, which is very close to the externally determined upper critical field of serum cobalt indium 5. But there's really no evidence for magnetism in serum cobalt indium 5 at zero field or in any field that we know of yet. So the question was whether this critical behavior was associated with a significant quantum phase transition or some sort of hidden magnetism. One obvious way to try to sort that question out was to pin dope serum cobalt in 5. And the short story is that basically pin doping serum cobalt in 5 suppresses the superconductivity, but this region of non-premium liquid behavior above the HT phase boundary just seems to track down, just continue to track as you suppress the superconductivity. And again, these data with more scatter scale in a Maria type way, which is expected for an itinerant sort of magnetic quantum critical point.
John, if I remember well, the linear inter-resistivity is at H equals 0 above superconductivity.
That's right.
At HC, it's some kind of exponent between sublinear. I remember
what has been
done by the
group of... Right, but I thought Piper actually finds T linear right at AC2 at the very lowest temperature, but it crosses over to some other larger power law, not T squared, as you move away from T equals zero. Maybe I'm remembering wrong.
So
at
AC2, when I say, my question is the power law of the resistivity the same?
Sorry, we don't know. We don't know. And it's just an experimental problem. That's really an experimental problem. And the problem is that sometimes how do I say, not, these are grown in an indium tin flux, and sometimes not all the indium, not all the tin is incorporated in the sample. So we have to be very careful about getting this unreacted, basically, superconductors out of the way, and they influence the way we would interpret the resistivity. So we just don't know the answer yet. So we're working on it. So anyway, this, even with tin doping, it looks like an itinerant quantum phase transition is probably not soon enough. Right? What I'm trying to say, I've tried to draw in a different way. It's a really terrible rendition, attempt at a three-dimensional plot. But basically, what there appears to be is just this huge volume in phase space of non-Fermi liquid behavior that within that is embedded this little cone of superconductivity that's just bounded by Tc, Ac2, and the critical tin concentrations required to completely suppress superconductivity. So if this really is not superconducting quantum criticality, and we think that's probably the case, then what is it? And unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you. But
why do you say it's not superconducting quantum criticality?
I think this, among other things, this just seems to be a remarkable coincidence, basically. I think it's too much of a coincidence that tin doping, how do I say, that the effect of disorder on both the superconductivity and the quantum criticality would just seem to go with each other.
That seems to be in support of the idea.
I guess I think not, actually.
That's what I wanted you to explain. Why you think it's
because
not?
It depends on where the tin goes. But I would guess that if it's really superconductivity, assuming quantum critical point, that the superconductivity would not persist off of such a large concentration, basically. This should be killed off. Somehow, the way I'm looking at this, and tell me, I'd be glad to be told this wrong, is that somehow there is this extended region of non-Fermi liquid behavior that's essentially protected by the superconductivity. Once the superconductivity is destroyed, and I wouldn't consider that a quantum, assuming I can quantum critical point, but once the superconductivity is destroyed, then you recover the Fermi liquid state.
But there is no extended region of non-Fermi. There's one point of non-Fermi behavior at T equals zero. And it's exactly.
No, the non-Fermi liquid behavior, at least in specific heat, covers this whole phase boundary, this whole everything that's not yellow and magenta.
Sure. If you did go to the concentration where the superconductivity disappears altogether,
right?
What do you see then?
You see logarithmic type specific heat.
At zero field.
But is there any evidence that the superconductivity is non-BCS like? I mean, that the instability is not from one that we expect out of a Fermi liquid, but it is an unusual type of instability. I mean, is the upper critical field higher than you might
naively
expect?
It's probably limited in this case, and that's the other reason I think it's probably not assuming quantum critical point. In fact, this boundary is first order here, right?
Well, once you disorder it, becomes second order.
It becomes second order.
But also, how big do you find in the pure material, right, they have a huge specific heat jump at TC.
Right.
What happens to the size of the jump as you disorder it? I
don't remember. Sorry, I just don't remember.
Yeah, but just following up your argument, supposing superconductivity is hiding some nascent non-Fermi liquid phase, then why is it that the Fermi liquid on the right-hand side knows that its T0 has to go to zero exactly where the superconductivity does?
That's what I'm saying.
How does it know?
Right.
It knows even before it gets there. It's going, oh, okay, superconductivity is coming soon, guys. Let's lower T0. Surely.
No. I don't know. I mean, I hope we can discuss this more. I really hope we can discuss this more, because I'm just telling you why I think it's happening.
Okay.
So maybe just two more minutes or so. So.
Just one more time to back on that same question. The entropy of the system at that superconducting position, is that satisfying? So basically, are you getting rid of all the entropy into the superconducting condensate?
As I recall, the answer is more or less yes. So how do I tell you what I remember? What I remember is that the entropy at some finite temperature, 15 degrees or something, is essentially independent of tin concentration. So okay. below that temperature, you always recover essentially R12. So, let's see. So let's come back to the maybe what cerimonium indium 5 is telling us. So I mentioned that the cell volume is smaller, implies that cerium cobalt indium 5 is roughly under 16 kilobar pressure, and if we just shift the temperature pressure phase diagram of cerium cobalt indium 5, it more or less lays on top of that of cerimonium indium 5, but of course this comparison is not very sensitive, and the Gauss and Alpha measurements would actually suggests that cerium cobalt indium 5 is probably much closer to cerium rhodium indium 5, just at this quantum phase transition of about 24 or 25 kilobars or so. So when we apply pressure to cerium cobalt indium 5, if we believe it's very near a quantum phase transition at p equals zero, then applying pressure will move cerium cobalt away from that quantum critical point, just like it does with pressure and cerium rhodium indium 5 and sends up cerium cobalt indium 5. But in fact, the semi-liquid-like properties of cerium cobalt indium 5 are really not recovered until rather high pressure of about 20 kilobars or so, where the temperature-dependent exponent of resistivity increases to d squared. The residual resistivity collapses and becomes essentially constant, and 1 over T1 takes on Fermi liquid, or close to Fermi liquid, constant behavior above about 20 kilobars. So, summarize what relationships we seem to be finding now in cerium rhodium indium 5 is we say at atmospheric pressure and 10 dopa, the suppressed NAL temperature, we find specific keys and scaling that looks very similar to what is found in the tritium rhodium 2 silicon 2, which is believed to have a localized, delocalized, or small to large Fermi surface volume change in its quantum phase transition. There appears to be this triangle of structure pressure of hidden magnetism that reveals itself at a quantum phase transition where it certainly seems to be a small to large Fermi surface change. And then the cerium cobalt indium 5 we believe is probably somewhere in, roughly would be placed on somewhere on the phase diagram about there. It already has a large Fermi surface and appears to have these partially unscreened F moments at least above TC. And so one of the real questions is what happens to that unscreened moment at lower temperatures. And then there's also the Maria-like scaling in cerium cobalt indium 5 and 10 dope cerium cobalt indium 5, which suggests these quantum criticalities of a itinerant magnetic type. And then I just want to come back to this point about the residual resistivity of cerium cobalt indium 5. It collapses by a large amount, roughly an order of magnitude, from already a small number, I should show it. It's about 2 or 3 micron centimeters to something like a fraction of a micron centimeter at about 20 kilobars or so, which may mark the appearance of a fully coherent condo state. It's obvious that I don't know how to interpret what we're seeing, but this end with some speculative thoughts, really speculative thoughts. So what I'm wondering basically is that in fact this unscreened moment that's found in cerium cobalt indium 5 atmospheric pressure really is not incorporated into the Fermi surface, even at t equals zero, and it's prevented from becoming incorporated because superconductivity somehow is preventing that from happening. And that it really is this unscreened moment that is producing the non-Fermi liquid excitations that are found in transport and thermodynamic properties. And so it's really not until that there's I don't know how you want to call it, sufficient hybridization or inter-side coupling to really make that partially screened moment become part of the large Fermi surface. It's not until you reach that point that you've really reached a coherent Fermi, you've really reached a coherent Kondo lattice or Fermi liquid state with maximally large Fermi surface. So in fact, the way I'm looking at this right now, which again is probably wrong, is that superconductivity, it's not a supernatural quantum physics point, but it's really the superconductivity that's preventing this material from entering a Fermi liquid regime right at the critical boundary. And so terbium loading to silicon II, in this sense, may just be a simple analog. It doesn't have the superconductivity to get in the way. So you can cross from a non-Fermi liquid state to a Fermi liquid state as a function of some tuning parameter like field. But it's actually the superconductivity in serum cobalt 5 and serum rhodium 5 that's preventing that from happening immediately. And that's why there's this extended region of non-Fermi liquid behavior. So that's sort of the end.
Thank you.
I have a question about this tick dot case of serum rhodium 5. When the dot is about the critical concept of the critical value, is the T square resistivity actually steep?
No, only so far, only one sample above that composition has been measured, and that was rather far away. It appeared to be T linear, but the residual resistivity is also very high, and it's also only been measured down to 300 millikelvin.
And presumably there's not a measurement of the magnetic water quality as a function of T concentration.
And so this is in the rhodium in the fire, or is it cobalt in the fire? The rhodium in the fire. No, there is none. No.
That would be very nice.
A lot of work to be done.
Questions against coexistence of superconductivity and magnetic it's known that obviously you can use more complicated structures to
I guess the answer is no. But the answer is no because I think the measurements just haven't been made to look for that. So actually part of this collaboration that we have with the Vanna group was in fact to not look for what we've discussed today, that was sort of be a byproduct of what we were actually looking at, was to look for a full feral state in serum rhodium in 5 under pressure, but in which case it would have been much more of an extensive study of specific heat and other things as a function of heat, but we just haven't done that yet.
It was actually this notion by Frank Stiglitz suggesting that local quantum criticality prevents superconductivity. So your system seems to be...
I don't know if that's necessarily inconsistent. I don't know if that's necessarily inconsistent.
Look at the space separating out, you could argue.
Right.
In fact, put another way, you could say that there's a lot of evidence for a large repulsive term between the two types of phases.
Again, I want to get a little bit clearer to this. You said if I had the turbine rhodium to the silicon II, and I would add superconductivity, maybe then I could understand what you've been seeing. If I just try to draw the picture, it just doesn't work with me. I have one critical point to begin with, and if I have to walk in the future, it's just gone.
Right.
Yet you see a critical point. I just still don't understand.
That's what I said. I probably am not saying what I think. Well, I really am thinking. I don't know how to say what I'm trying to think, I guess, is the way to say it. In the sense that it seems to me, one possibility is that superconductivity, instead of, is projecting the quantum critical point and, in fact, drawing it out into a line of quantum critical points. I guess maybe that's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. But what is, of course, intriguing is that even, if I'm correct, even above the TC, the superconducting TC, is having non-term liquid behavior. Right, and that doesn't seem to be any reason that the mean field superconducting transistor should be even bigger, or so the fluctuation spectrum goes so well. I see this is supporting your point, but I just can't grasp it.
Right.
Let me see whether this is what you are trying to say.
Okay, thanks.
Sometimes one way to think of the problem is that I can either have the magnetic order state or have the superconducting state. Yes. And the two repel each other.
Yeah.
So in terminal order to the silicon tool, there is the magnetism to parallel magnet state transition, and the corresponding the critical point happens to control a very large region of the temperature and magnetic field pressure space. You know? Mm-hmm. And I think what you're suggesting is that you see in cobalt indium 5, superconductivity is really magnetism in disguise.
Yeah.
And when the field drives the system away from superconducting state, it's like going from magnetic / superconducting state to a parallel magnet transition. Is that the picture you want to paint?
I'm not sure that's quite the picture I want to paint.
Okay.
I'm not sure that's quite the picture.
So that would just be saying, indeed, this is a superconducting quantum critical.
That's right.
We are just calling it not magnetic anymore, but now superconductive.
Right.
But that's what it says.
Yeah, but that's different from the PCS.
That's another story again, but whether the critical mode which causes the non-term liquid behavior at that point is due to the superconducting phase or not.
We think it's not. And there are actually a couple of experiments that I haven't discussed here that would argue that's also consistent with these other data.
Maybe time is over, just 10 seconds. I mean, in some sense, it might be more useful to think the transition as coming from the parallel magnetic side and say that the mass becomes divergent and some instability would emerge. And the instability that emerges could be leading to a magnetic order state or a superconducting state. And therefore, the critical behavior is really the reflection of this destruction of the parallel magnetic phase, or large fermions to small fermions, something like that. And the order state is a byproduct.
It really doesn't matter.
Which is not very essential for the critical behavior.
What I was asking about, the unusual signatures in superconductivity, I think one of the consequences of that picture is that superconductivity would be unexpectedly robust because it's being driven by something unusual. So, and you almost hinted that was the case, that the amount of tintaging that you had was that it was unusual that superconductivity was still surviving.
It's large. And similar with pressure, I mean, these phase spaces that are occupied by superconductivity are much larger than in any other unconventional thermal heavy fermion system that I'm aware of.
Why do you say that the two concentration dilution surprises is very large? Because if we divide 12 by 5, it's 2.4%.
12 by 5.
Right. I put 12%. It's 0.12. 10
divided by 5. Don't make much difference to the superconductivity. It seems to be what's in the plane.
So the average concentration is less.
It's actually higher.
It's higher.
So
it's 5% or something that, which case, yes. It's good. Thanks very much.